Okay, this is talking with George Stenson on 24 March 75 at the AAS meeting in Bloomington. So you say your first involvement with radio science and the ionosphere and so forth was in Alaska, actually.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I went to the University of Alaska, and I was in the physics department and teaching the electrical engineering curriculum single-handed. And Gordon Little came from Jodrell Bank to do some ionospheric research at college.
Right.
And I helped him develop some instrumentation for studying scintillation of radio sources.
Right, and when was this now?
And that was in the winter and spring of the academic year 53-54.
So it had been well established that the scintillation of the radio sources was ionospheric.
That's right, and in fact, at Jodrell Bank.
Right.
And Gordon came from that school and had, I guess, worked with, he'd worked with Alan Maxwell and had done his thesis in this general area and so on. So they had set up a program at college, and I, being the only electrical engineer around, sort of got involved in that as summer activity, and also I did a lot of electronic consulting for the Geophysical Institute through the year. And then I came back for the next couple of summers and worked on their program. In fact, I took over the design of the IGY ionospheric opacity measurement equipment.
I see. What sort of frequencies?
That was at 30 megahertz. During the IGY, they wanted to set up a network of rheometers around the world, especially through U.S.-controlled territory, and Gordon Little was charged with developing the standard IGY rheometer.
I see.
Now, one of my claims to fame is that I invented the word rheometer. When the summer of 1956, in fact, I was in charge of the work on the rheometer in Gordon Little's absence, and I had to have a word to call it. They didn't have a word yet, so. And in fact, we developed a whole vocabulary of the rheometer, but only the word itself stuck.
And how was it that you got more into radio astronomy as opposed to ionospheric?
Well, I was for years, I'd been looking for some way of applying my electronic expertise in some study of the universe outside the laboratory, and I would have been happy as a geophysicist of some kind. When I went back to the States, I went to Michigan State, and there I read in some of the electrical engineering periodicals about Bernie Burke and Ken Franklin's discovery of Jupiter decametric radiation, and I thought that was fascinating. I wrote to Bernie Burke, asked him how he ever achieved such a narrow beam width, realizing that it would have taken an enormous antenna, and the abstract I read didn't say anything about it. And he never answered me. But I ran into him at an IRSI meeting one time, and got acquainted with him, and then that may have been after I left. I guess that was probably, that was after I left Michigan State. Well, I knew a little bit about radio astronomy from my contacts with Gordon Little and my work on that scintillation project. And I'd read more, and I had gone over to Pontiac, Michigan to talk with Helen Dodson Prince, Helen Dodson at that time. Who was interested in radio astronomy in a sort of peripheral way, and I wanted to see if there wasn't some way I could get into radio astronomy through some collaboration with the people at Michigan. That never worked out.
They didn't have the 85 foot yet, did they?
I don't think they did. No, they didn't. I'm sure that would have been 1955.
Well, that you're talking about now. Yeah.
And 56. But then I went down to Chicago for a committee meeting one time. I ran into a fellow from Illinois, and he told me that they were trying to recruit electrical engineering faculty, and why didn't I come down to Urbana with him? We were grumbling about situation at Michigan State, which he was vaguely familiar with. Mm-hmm. I guess he saw an opportunity to recruit somebody. So I went down there, and the head of electrical engineering, hearing that I had had a little experience with radio astronomy, introduced me to George McVitie of the astronomy department.
Mm-hmm.
The upshot was that I negotiated a joint appointment in the two departments, which I've held ever since.
And this was when?
Well, I joined them in 1956.
And why was McVitie interested in the radio astronomy?
Well, he's a cosmologist, and he was interested in the log N, log S relationship,
yeah.
And he wanted to participate in an observational way, and he and Stan Wyatt had been talking about building a radio telescope, but didn't know enough electronics to do it themselves.
Right.
They'd negotiated with some physicists at Illinois, but that didn't pan out, and Mac had formed a friendship with Ed Jordan of Electrical Engineering, who, in fact, Mac had urged Ed Jordan to go to a meeting. I guess it must have been in about 54 probably, in Washington.
Yes, I know that meeting, yeah.
Yeah, at which the development of radio astronomy in the U.S. was being discussed, and Mac couldn't go, and Jordan, the head of EE, went instead, and they decided between them that they were going to have a radio astronomy program, and they'd just been keeping their eye open for somebody.
So when you got there, what were your plans to do? I mean, what did you
say? Well, I was told to learn radio astronomy, first of all, and there wasn't any way you could study it in books or anything at the time, so Mac negotiated with Joe Pozzi of CSIRO in Australia that I should go down and spend a little time down there. So in the spring of 57, I went down to Australia and spent 6 or 8 weeks with Bernie Mills and Joe Pozzi and Wilbur Christensen. And that was a wonderful, eye-opening experience. Because they're, you know, among the cream of the crop.
Right. And, well, was it that easy in 6 weeks to sort of catch on to almost all the tricks if you really knew electronics well?
Well, I think so. I got a rough idea of what I needed to do. And, of course, I was already a fairly well-seasoned antenna engineer.
Well, that's what I mean. So the applications to radio astronomy, it wasn't difficult to understand them once someone just showed
there
you.
There were some of the subtleties that didn't dawn on me for years, I'm sure, but at least that first trip around the world, I actually did conceive of and rough out the design of the 400-foot telescope that we ultimately built at Illinois. In fact, I got the idea for it at the Observatoire de Haute-Provence in France, talking with Lafeneur. And I realized that his idea could be developed in a much more business-like way and actually could amount to a good system for doing a deep sky catalog.
Right.
And that notion was sort of firmed up on the rest of my trip around the world.
This was all in 57 now you're talking about.
Yeah, in the spring of 57.
What was his idea?
Well, he had built these two chicken wire parabolic cylinders in Haute-Provence and was trying to do a sky survey, but it never materialized, apparently. So then I went to Jodrell Bank and talked extensively with Hanbury Brown, and he agreed that this looked like a promising scheme for a deep sky survey, a good way to build a really big telescope. And see, I wanted to do something a little bit novel.
Yeah, sure.
At the same time, because otherwise it wouldn't have interested me as an electrical engineer. At the same time, I wanted a useful enough instrument so it could do other things besides simply discrete sorts, source surveys. So I didn't really want to build an interferometer like Ryle's, but I...
Or a Mills Cross, yeah.
And I didn't want to build a Mills Cross because that had been done. I guess if you really probe my motors, that had been done.
Yeah.
I thought this would be a better instrument for a wider variety of uses. And I also wanted to do the survey at a different frequency from the Mills Cross, you see. I visualized that we had to go deeper into the sky than the Mills Cross was doing. I mean, they were confusion limited at a certain flux density, right. And so was the Cambridge system. Now, of course, the Cambridge people, and Mills as well, had other ideas that they were cooking, but which they didn't advertise to me at the time. But I learned a lot from all of those people.
But now, how did you think you were going to get over the confusion problem?
Well, I was going to go to a higher frequency. Pozzi and I planned this out quite carefully. Pozzi was a remarkable guy. There was very little chauvinism to him. He was very much interested in our program and making a success of it, and he helped me enormously. And he sort of pointed the way to the analysis of the confusion problem. And in fact, I did an analysis of the confusion problem while I was there in his lab in Australia.
I see.
And decided that a filled aperture dish about 400 feet in diameter operating at about 600 megahertz would be the right thing to do to go down to one flux unit, which is where we thought we had to go for the next step.
And this is while the Ryle versus Mills controversy is raging full force.
Yes.
Right.
I wasn't really very much aware of it. I knew the two people had some controversial attitudes towards each other, but I was really more interested in the technicalities of it all, and I only became interested in the personalities and the conflicts and so on as I got to know them better later years. So after that trip around the world, I came back to the States, and I thought a lot more about different things to do, different kinds of interferometry and different kinds of single dish systems and so on. And finally I decided to build this parabolic cylinder. And we interested the Office of Naval Research. My original studies were sponsored by the university, but then once we got a proposal together, the ONR picked it up.
I get the feeling that it was not difficult to get money from ONR at that time, it seems like.
ONR, in fact, was trying to spread their money around to a number of different institutions, and they had negotiated with McVitie to set up a project. I think the initiative...
They instigated it.
I'm not sure that they did. I'm not sure that they did, but at any rate, they had an early meeting of the minds between McVitie and Arnold Shostak, who was sort of the fairy godmother of radio astronomy in the United States at that time.
In what sense? At ONR?
Well, I mean, he was the director of the electronics program in ONR.
I see.
And he was very sympathetic to radio astronomy and nurtured it and funded it, of course, with the blessing of his superiors, Randall Robertson and others in the...
Do you know where he is now?
Yeah, Randall Robertson is...
No, I meant Shostak.
Oh, Shostak is retired.
And do you know where he lives?
In Washington somewhere.
I should maybe try to talk to him.
Yeah, oh yes, Arnold would be a marvelous... I think he's got a teaching position at one of the small colleges around Washington. Maybe on a part-time basis, I'm not sure.
Arnold, did you remember his middle initial, or...?
Don't think he has one.
Okay. That's S-H-O-S-T-A-K?
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
So,
now, if you can get him to talk about business, he can give you an enormous amount of information. He's a very astute and fine person. But he has this sort of frivolous exterior that you got to get under, and he'll tell you jokes until you're blue in the face. But he's a great guy, and when you talk to him, give him my regards.
Okay.
His son is a radio astronomer.
Oh, I see. Seth Shostak
is
his son.
Seth is his son, yeah. Actually, Seth is working for the Pennsylvania Railroad now. But
I do know Seth, yeah. That's interesting.
So you could perhaps locate him through Seth if necessary.
Right. Okay, so you got the money from ONR, and when did you actually begin building this dish?
Well, let's see. We started building the 400-foot
something like that.
I suppose about the fall of 1968, or maybe the...
58, yeah.
Or maybe... Yeah, I think in the fall of 58 we started moving dirt, and then we had to suspend everything during the winter, and started again in the summer of 59. Mm-hmm. And I guess we got our first observation probably the fall of 1960 or some time like that, and then immediately shut the whole thing down to redo the electronics, which were not satisfactory the first time around, although we got our first publication out of it before.
The first publication was what?
It was a map of Cygnus X, the Cygnus X right. region at 600 megahertz.
In AJ? Or was
probably AJ.
AJ?
Yeah.
And what was unsatisfactory about the electronics?
Well, it wasn't sensitive enough. We'd missed the mark on conceptually on the design of the transmission line system. These were electronic technicalities that we didn't do right the first time. We had to do it over again. That took us quite a little while.
You mean too much loss in the cables, basically? You mean? Or?
We tried to match all the cables to the transmission line. We later found that it was much more practical if we tolerated a large mismatch between the antennas and the traveling wave transmission mm-hmm. line. And this is all discussed. Our final system is all discussed in detail in a paper in the I guess 1960 PGAP transactions. There's a radio astronomy issue.
Oh yes, a special issue in radio astronomy. 64, I think it was.
Oh no, it was earlier than that. There were two papers describing our...
Maybe it was 62.
There were two papers describing the whole system. Three, actually. There was one in the transactions on military electronics.
Oh, that's the one I'm thinking of.
That paper was by McVitie, and that described the cosmological considerations. Mm-hmm. Then there was a paper in PGAP, which I believe was probably 1960, something like that. I'm pretty sure it was in 1960, because there was the special issue on radio astronomy of the proceedings.
That was 58.
It was 58, and then I think the next one was 2 years later, and that was in PGAP. And Y.T. Lowe and I wrote a paper on the theory of the antenna. And then in about 2 years later, something like that, so say 1962 or 63, there was a paper in the in Radio Science by K.S. Yang and me, describing the electronic system.
Okay.
So that's all.
I'll check those out.
Yeah.
Did you have any particular troubles with the dish itself? Was that pretty straightforward?
Not initially. The contractors did a good job of making the dish as we had designed it, and it was very smooth and in very good condition when we began. I remember Hanbury Brown came and looked at it and says, "Oh, you can easily use this at 21 centimeters." Mm-hmm. And so it was a very large dish.
And this was the only one of this design.
Anywhere near that size. Yeah. It was the largest single dish paraboloid in the world for a long time. I guess it still is, but... well, no, it isn't now.
Yeah.
Some of these... This big thing at Serpukhov would probably have that.
But now, okay, so you redid the electronics, and then that the only observations you did with the old electronics was a map of Cygnus X region. So you only did that one project with the original receiver, or the original...
Well, we did a lot of things with it. We mapped as much of the sky as we had time to for discrete sources.
Even with the old receiver?
Wait a minute. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was I interpreted receiver to mean antenna. We didn't change the receiver. We just changed the transmission.
Only the line lines, okay.
Yeah. That was a rather tricky problem, as you'll see if you read through that stuff. But,
okay, so then once you got that fixed up, then what was the program?
Then we just started surveying the sky. Now, my original notion was that this telescope could be made a very fast and versatile instrument because we could have put a multiple feed system into it very easily. In other words, simply by adding more receivers, we could have put more beams on the sky very easily.
Right.
And I always had in mind to do that. Now, that's what Mills had done with his original Mills Cross and also with his second Mills Cross, but I never was able to scrounge up the funds to buy those other receivers and all the rest of the transmission line arrangements and so on. So we always struggled along with one beam, which made it a very slow project, and it also meant that other people better funded were able to get ahead of us in the mapping.
The VRO survey went over many, many years then.
It did. We operated the telescope for 10 years, and we were surveying for much of that time.
Mm.
And we've published a series of sections of catalog, which you may be familiar with.
Did it do anything in between, any short little projects?
When we crossed the galaxy, we recorded the galactic flux, and we made a map of the whole galaxy, which we could see, which I think is still probably the most comprehensive and detailed map at that resolution, at that wavelength. And I think ought to have some uses. Yeah. That's all in the literature.
But it didn't really, it seems to me, turn into a general purpose instrument like you were originally talking about.
No. In that sense, it didn't.